Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz, and joined this time by Lahav Harko, who is not in the same country as I am, but is actually joining us from Casablanca. Lahav, how is Morocco?
Morocco is beautiful and interesting. I highly recommend visiting, but don't throw away your watch when you're here, because nobody does anything remotely on time. If you think Israelis are not punctual, be prepared for everything to start an hour late in Morocco. And once you get over that, you'll enjoy things. Like, if you're going for work purposes to meet with people like I am, you'll enjoy it a lot more once you realize everyone will be very late for everything.
They're less punctual than Israelis? Wow, that says a lot.
Yes. A lot of things about Morocco are very Western, you know, like they have a lot of French influence, but they definitely have not adopted the rat race.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. By the way, that means that our current prime minister and our just recent former prime minister would do well there, because the two of them are also notorious. Naftali Bennett and Benjamin Netanyahu are notorious for also constantly starting discussions and meetings and briefings and conferences late. So there you go.
I haven't found Bennett to be as bad as Bibi was in terms of that, though. Bibi could be like hours late.
Hours late, yes. I have great stories of when he was supposed to come on stage at a conference, and I had to burn time somehow because he just wasn't yet there. That was one of my more uncomfortable situations in life, I could say. I wasn't sure exactly how to do that. But anyhow, tell us, what is the sense in Morocco? Because this week has been an interesting week, and we're going to talk a bit about the tragic death of Shirin Abu Akla, the Al Jazeera journalist who was caught in crossfire last week between IDF soldiers and Palestinian gunmen in the city of Jenin, and her death has sparked major controversy. Then her funeral this past Friday was a complete disaster that we definitely need to discuss. But has that impacted your trip to Morocco, meetings that you've had, you were supposed to have, maybe didn't have, or kind of shadowed over, cast a shadow over?
Yeah, so this delegation I'm with, I should say, it's sponsored by an NGO called Sharaka. Sharaka means partnership in Hebrew, and it encourages people-to-people connections between Israelis and residents of Abraham Accords countries. So we hadn't even taken off from Israel yet when Shirin Abu Akla was shot. And I was a little worried, like, are there going to be protests? I might have been overestimating the profile of this video, thinking people might protest us. But it has impacted the trip, because anyone who's, like, in any kind of official capacity, you know, any politicians, you know, we were supposed to meet with ministers, members of parliament, mayors, and many of them canceled because they didn't want to be seen with us. I did speak with an important politician in the end, but this person asked not to be identified, not even in the position this person has, you know, not just not by name. So it definitely impacted in that sense. I mean, people here, the problem from a lot of people I've spoken to who have been working on sort of coexistence issues and are in favor of the Abraham Accords, is that they feel like this, the king is relatively beloved in Morocco, but it's like a decision that the king made, and then that was it. Like, they didn't do the work to teach the people or try to convince the people of why it's a good decision. And so anyone who didn't like Israel doesn't like Israel anymore, just like they're not allowed to be as vocal about it. So that's a difficult situation, you know, and Al Jazeera is very popular here. You know, they get the same kind of Arabic media that the rest of the MENA region gets. And so they think that, you know, Israel, quote unquote, murdered a journalist so the world won't know what's happening to the Palestinians, which we know is not the case. But that's how things are being filtered in the Arab world.
And the Shirin Abu Akla death, even though it's unclear who was the one whose bullet actually hit her and killed her has very much been blamed on Israel. So any public display, I'm guessing, in Morocco of these people who don't necessarily love Israel that much, they want to kind of tamper down, right? They don't want it to be as public.
Yeah. I mean, us in the delegation, we sort of didn't change anything, right? Like, we've been walking around speaking Hebrew and, like, but, you know, in the markets and in tourist places, people here speaking Hebrew and they come up and they say to us like Manishma or Rega Rega, like whatever phrase they've learned to call Israelis over so that we'll give them our money. You know, that's still going on. And like when we walk around, like this, we walked around the souk in Marrakesh and everywhere we went, they said, oh, Israel is our family. Like there's a bunch of people who are like Israelis of Moroccan origin on the trip. And people were like, oh, you're Moroccan. You're our family. But at the same time, like, I don't think we're meeting, you know, and in our meetings, they're all with people who, or almost all with people who want to encourage coexistence, or the delegation itself is actually about culture and high tech, and I'm just, you know, writing about it. So these are people who want to cooperate, but the sense that the people who want to cooperate have given us, and also the fact that we basically have police meeting us everywhere we go, and my understanding is that more so than had been planned in advance, is that there are a lot of people who are very angry, you know, and less interested in seeing and talking to Israelis.
Well, Lahav, so you on Friday, I don't know exactly what you were doing, whether you were in Casablanca or another Moroccan city, traveling around, meeting interesting people, but here in Israel, we were watching in horror as the police were beating back the pallbearers of Shirin Abu Akleh's casket in just outside the hospital.
St. Joseph, I think.
St. Joseph, right, in East Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And just couldn't understand what was the police thinking? Like, what in God's name was going through these people's minds, knowing that this funeral is so high profile, so controversial, so the fact that the world is blaming Israel, and the solution to that is we should be taking bats to people who are carrying her casket and might almost drop it. I mean,
you know, it was a lose-lose situation, and somehow the police managed to lose even worse.
Although,
it's lose-lose because people were being violent, and the tens of thousands of people, you know, they weren't respecting what the family wanted, right? Which, if people don't know, because it hasn't been reported well in a lot of places, is that the family wanted a hearse to drive from the hospital to the church because she's Christian. And instead, a bunch of Palestinians, I can't identify them, but they grabbed the coffin and started marching it through the streets. So for starters, the police tried to stop that. And then there was violence and people were throwing rocks and bottles and things at police. So it's like, on the one hand, you know, the police can't let people throw rocks in the street. People could get hurt, including the people who are at the funeral because they love Shireen, right? But on the other hand, they handled it so poorly. I mean, I don't know. I'm not an expert in policing, but it just, like, I am sure that there was something else they could have done.
Here's how I look at it, right? So last year in 2021, there was, during the month of Ramadan, the police, for different reasons, decided that they're closing off near Damascus Gate. There's like an amphitheater and stairs and a place to sit. And every night at the end of Ramadan, young people would go there and have listen to music and eat and dance or whatever it would be. And they decided to shut that down, and it caused a lot of tension and friction, and there was nightly violence there. This year, the police chief in Jerusalem decided to not do that and to keep it open.
Right.
And Ramadan actually went by out of Damascus Gate. It went by quietly. Prime Minister Bennett even invited, in a very public display, the police chief of Jerusalem, Doron Turgeman, to his office to thank him for getting Israel through a quiet Ramadan.
Well, I don't know. I mean, we didn't have a quiet Ramadan, though. There was all this rioting on the Temple Mount and stabbings of Jews.
We had rioting on the Temple Mount, but not in Damascus Gate. And Damascus Gate went by relatively quiet.
Okay.
And also, if you look at some of the terrorist attacks,
they weren't in Jerusalem.
Many of them did not actually. They weren't in Jerusalem. They weren't during Ramadan. But that, put that aside. But what the lesson was from that was that if the police aren't necessarily there, there doesn't have to be violence. Now, I'm not saying that the police should just let criminals run rampant and do whatever they want and throw rocks or whatever. But why were they even there with bats? Like, why were they even near where this funeral was taking place? Like, someone should have had the common sense to say, this is not going to end well. We need to step back. We need to, you know, contain the area, but we shouldn't be right near where this is all going down. And there was just no consideration and no thought, I think, that went into this, and just a complete disaster. Like, anyone who thought that Israel was at fault for this for her death definitely blames Israel for it now. And this was a disaster. Just a disaster.
Yeah. If it was just the shooting, I think that we could have maybe gotten over the hump. You know, like, I think that the fact that there's no evidence, maybe it would have stuck. And instead, we had, I mean, you know, I'm on the diplomatic side, so many countries just like condemning what they said, like excessive police force. That was like the phrase that was being used over and over again by European diplomats, by the State Department, by the White House, which of course is ironic because we know how much excessive police force is used in the U.S. And also quite a bit in Europe when there were protests against COVID vaccines. There's a lot of videos of that.
But how do you explain where were the people? Where were, you know, there's a prime minister, there's a police minister, there's a defense minister, there's the public diplomacy directorate or whatever it's called. There's the foreign ministry. Where were the people who are supposed to say, guys, be careful?
And you know what's amazing is like the day before Bennett posted like on Instagram, like of how proud he is of the head of the public diplomacy directorate, because he really like, they managed to get the message out that there's no there's no evidence that Israel shot Shireen. And then, of course, a day later, it was just, it all fell apart.
Because there was just...
I mean, I don't even think it was warranted in the first place. Like, I don't know that Israel did a bad job, but it was very clear in an event like that that we were going to lose the narrative war immediately, and then all we could do is play defense.
Yeah, but I think that is, you know, why did he tweet that out? Because... he also said he posted on Instagram. I saw it on Twitter, but he did so because Israel did succeed in getting some major news channels around the world to report that it's under investigation and that is, you know, there's no clear evidence that it was Israel. Okay. Wow. Amazing. But what I think we're failing to recognize is it's kind of like the forest and the trees, right? We're looking at the bullet. Was it our bullet? Was it a Palestinian bullet? Like, as if that's going to determine the fate of this conflict. No.
No, of course, because even if it is a Palestinian bullet, like, anyone who thinks this way is going to say, well, she wouldn't have been killed if there wasn't a quote-unquote occupation.
Exactly. And Israel shouldn't have been in there. And why were Israeli troops going into a Palestinian city?
Right.
Right. So the bullet is less important. Of course, you have to do everything to explain and to determine the truth and get to the bottom of it. And that's what every country should do. And Israel was trying to do that and offered a joint investigation to the Palestinians, who, of course, never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. So they, rejected that. But this is about the conflict. And Israelis there, Lahav, in my view, and this is what bothers me, Israelis don't want to have to deal with that, right? We prefer not to have to think about the conflict, right?
Right.
Let's focus on the bullet. The bullet is the issue. No, it's not. It's even for Israelis, the bullet's not the issue. There's a conflict. And we prefer to ignore that this conflict exists.
Yeah. You know, on this trip, we have a couple of Israeli Arabs who are in the high-tech sphere, really nice guys. And then we also have someone who's a filmmaker, like a documentary filmmaker, who's like very, very, very far left. I would call him like kind of post-Zionist. He's not religious and he votes Shas because he doesn't want to vote for a Zionist party. But he's Sephardic. So. anyway, and we've had a lot of really interesting...
The complex reality of Israel.
Yeah, we've had some really interesting conversations. Sometimes I just want to like be like, okay, I've had enough. Like, how much do we have to talk about? Like, how complex our reality is. You know, and I'll joke like, okay, have we solved the conflict yet? But it is so complex. And it is something that, you know, you have to hear people out, and you have to think about the fact that there are people, you know, that there are human beings on the other side. And like in the case of the funeral, I felt like it was really just such a case of like not thinking of the fact that it's human beings. You know, it just, you have to remember that. And that would, I think, help us. That would go a long way for us. Although, you know, whatever, that being said, you know, we go out of our way not to strike civilians in a way that like nobody else does, like in Gaza. So obviously we do think about humans, but it doesn't always happen.
Another illustration of this, or what's so telling, is actually, I noticed by Mirav Micheli. Mirav Micheli is the chairwoman of the Labor Party, right? Labor Party is the party of Peres, Rabin, Ben-Gurion, Golda Meir, right? The famous party that built the country, that constantly sought peace with the Palestinians. May 11th was when Shirin Abu Akleh was shot and killed in Jenin. Since then, Mirav Micheli has tweeted on her Twitter page dozens of times, right? Dozens of different tweets.
Mainly about parental leave Correct. For fathers, which I'm excited about.
Yes. Fantastic. Great. But not a single tweet about Shirin Abu Akleh, not a single tweet about the conflict with the Palestinians, not a single tweet. I mean, what is going on here? The Labor Party, right, has nothing to say anymore about what's going on?
She's also a former journalist. And like when she was a journalist, I bet she would have had a lot to say about a journalist being shot.
Oh, but she's got a lot to say about paternity leave, right? About the fact that fathers now are going to get 2 weeks off, which is great. Fantastic. Didn't get it for my four kids, but I hope all fathers get to enjoy it. But you have nothing to say, right? A member of the security cabinet, the leader of the Labor Party, you don't have a thing to say about what's going on. They were just last night, we're recording this on Tuesday. Just last night, there was violence that spilled over into the streets of East Jerusalem. There was another funeral of another Palestinian Arab.
Yeah.
There's plenty to say here, but she's completely silent. And I think that's just so telling of this overall paralysis, I think, to an extent, that takes over Israel when it comes to having to think about, wait, one second, there is this problem? Yeah, let's prefer not to talk about it. It's easier.
I mean, I also think it has a lot to do with why the left is so weak in Israel, in a way, because I think, like, in theory, the left should have some kind of message about, I don't know, human rights, freedom of press, the balancing of the use of power. You know, that might be different from what we hear from Bennett or even Yair Lapid, who Yair Lapid is not right wing, but he doesn't have like left wing socialist way of viewing things the way Labor and Meretz do. You know, and if they could contribute their unique voice of, you know, supporting Israel while also looking at things from a left-wing perspective, like maybe there'll be people in the world who would connect to that and
right.
see Israel in a more positive light, or at least understand a little more. She has what to contribute here, I think.
I completely agree, but that's not happening. Lahav, you might be in Morocco, but I know that you're also following the events that have been taking place here politically, and it's not looking too hot for the Prime Minister of Israel and his coalition. There was a shakeup in his office on Friday. His diplomatic advisor, Shimrit Meir, who had been with him since the beginning of his term as prime minister, decided to step down. There's been some infighting within that office, but also just the overall coalition doesn't seem so stable. And there's been some reports that one of the reasons that Shimrit Meir, a former journalist with Yedioth Ahronot, decided to step down was that she wanted to basically, that the ship was sinking, better to get out ahead than wait for it to come collapsing down.
Well, certainly because she's being blamed for the beginning of the collapse.
Well, yes.
Justifiably or not.
But by the people who are in the office, the office is split between those on the right who want to keep Bennett within his base and the claims that Shimrit was taking him to the center or to the left to try to open up Bennett to potentially new constituencies and new voters. But this government, the clock is ticking, right? I mean, that's my assumption from what I'm hearing. People talk about possibly it collapsing within a matter of weeks.
Yeah, I mean, the clock started ticking the minute Idit Silman, who was the chairwoman of the coalition, or, you know, like the whip, the majority whip, she quit and switched sides, right? And then the two sides were tied. You have 60 coalition, 60 opposition. Now, it's a little more complicated than that because the joint list, you know, that sort of group of Arab parties is in the opposition. So it's not like they're really voting together with Bibi. But it, the coalition can't be sustained that long without a majority. And certainly, you know, the Lapid and Bennett like to say, oh, there have been minority coalitions in the past that have lasted a long time. Sure, but they weren't minority coalitions that ran the gamut politically from, you know, solidly right wing to the far left and an Arab party. It was hard to sustain even when they had a narrow majority. So now that they are tied, it just, you know, it's a sinking ship, like you said. They're you know, it's like playing violin on the Titanic.
The big question is, you know, Bennett, Lieberman, and Gantz and Lapid have all been speaking about how they want to pass a budget within the next few weeks, and everyone's talking about how would they pass a budget. Well, the solution is what you just mentioned, is that the Arab Joint List would provide them with cover from outside the government and help them pass a budget, which leads me to question, you want to tell me that Ayelet Shaked, Nir Orbach, these members of Yamina who are already unhappy with this government are going to agree to having another Arab party give the support that it's needed to pass a budget that they'll accept? I don't know. I find that hard to see happening, but anything's possible, I guess.
I don't think it's going to happen, but maybe they can offer the joint list something really huge. But that'll hurt the coalition because Yamina doesn't want to do that.
Right, right. Well, time will tell. The clock is ticking, as we said, and we'll see what happens with this government. This week's interview, Lahav, you met with Jeremy Dahan, a member of the Moroccan Jewish community. You want to tell us just quickly who Jeremy is?
Yeah, so he is the president of an organization called Salam Lekulam, which they started after the Abraham Accords to promote Jewish-Muslim coexistence in Morocco, which is something... On the one hand, you know, Jews have lived in Morocco for many centuries. Some say, you know, going all the way back to the destruction of the temple. And every community in the diaspora had its violent periods and had its bad periods. But Morocco was a relatively good place for Jews to live really throughout the ages. And so they're very proud of that. And they talk a lot about Jewish-Muslim coexistence here. That being said, when there wasn't relations with Israel... a lot of things that we would see as Jewish were viewed as Zionist. Mm-hmm. So it was a lot easier to start organizations and to be sort of activists when it comes to religious coexistence after the Abraham Accords were signed. He started this organization. They've started their activities in the last few months, and he's also been living in Morocco. And so he's talked about what it's like, you know, being a Jew in a Arab Muslim country, and how things have changed since the Abraham Accords.
Okay, well, here's the interview with Jeremy Dahan.
So I am here in Casablanca with Jeremy Dahan, who is the president of Shalom Aleikum.
It's not Shalom Aleikum, it's Salam Lekulam.
Salam Lekulam, right.
But we have hesitated on the name, so it's okay.
Okay, so Salam Lekulam, Salam being hello in Arabic, and Lekulam meaning to everyone in Hebrew, and it's an interfaith organization. First of all, tell us about it.
So this association is quite new, but that's the live together is not so new in Morocco, you know, because for a long time and in my personal life, I have always play with my Muslim friends and work with my Muslim friends and our colleague, etc. So we were doing a lot of things together, and it was not the case in other countries. And during this this year, we wanted to share our life way to everybody in the world, and to share that it's possible to live together and to have a lot of interaction between Muslim and Jews.
So you formed your organization very recently, and your first event was a joint iftar.
Yes.
How did that go, first of all?
It was really important to have such an event like this we call this the Ftour pluriel, okay? Ftour, it's iftar. We call it Ftour in Morocco, and pluriel, it's like everybody. And it was really important for us to share what we do every year in Morocco, and to share a dinner with our friends, and it was a specific day for us because we did this event in a kosher place. Mm-hmm. We did this event with two other associations. One, it's called the SOC, and the SOC is a Jewish association, mm-hmm. a Jewish club. in Casablanca and with Avender Association Marocain Pluriel, and together we have organized this this event, and we have invited some people from every religion in Morocco. Okay, so Muslim, Jews, Christian also, and we had the chance to have with us André Azoulay, the advisor of the king, and
who is Jewish.
Who is Jewish?
Yes.
Yes. And it was great to have him with us. We are the also some ambassadors, Spain, France, US. Mm-hmm. And what was really important for us, it's a lot of our young people went to this event. Muslim and Jews, young people were also with us to this event.
So did the timing of this organization, the fact that it was only founded recently, have to do with the Abraham Accords, with the normalization between Morocco and Israel? Did that make this kind of activity easier?
Sure. It makes easier the organization, but this coexistence between Jews and Muslim is in Morocco for a long time.
For centuries,
yeah,
really.
For centuries, yeah. Yes. Yeah, you're right. It was a special event, the first event in presidential after these accords, but that's our way of life.
So I'm here in Morocco with this Israeli delegation, and the day we arrived here was the day that the journalist Shireen Abu Akleh was shot. And we've had a few people who didn't, mainly politicians, who didn't want to meet with us because they thought that it would be sort of provocative, that they would their voters would be angry at them. How does the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians impact the way, first of all, the way normalization is seen, and second of all, does it have an impact on just Jewish life in Morocco?
It's not an easy question, you know?
Yeah.
To be honest, we have the chance to have His Majesty, the King of Morocco, who does a lot for the Jewish community in terms of security. So for the king, the father of the king and the grandfather of the king, there is no Jews in Morocco. There is only Moroccans, okay? Moroccan, they are Jews or they are Muslim, but they are Moroccans. So he does a lot for the security, for our security, for the Jewish Jewish community in terms of security, and even during this period. So for us Moroccan Jews, we don't feel a special tension during this time, but for sure, the TVs are here, the news are here also, and we can have some tensions, but not on not with the population, you know. For us, it's the it was a so sad event, but in our way of living our Judaism here in Morocco, we don't have so much impact.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and you know, you lived in France, right?
Yes.
You grew up in France and you moved to Morocco.
Yeah.
And so you sort of have a perspective of living as a Jew in different communities. What is new, exciting, different about Morocco?
You know, we have, I was living in France with my wife and my children, and my wife has also his father from Morocco, but we have together the Morocco in our hearth, and it was a new kind of experience to come here in Morocco, but not so much a new experience, but back to the roots. Mm-hmm. To be here, and And here we have the chance to live our Judaism in totally free,
openly.
Openly, there is no question of security. You can my children are in some Jewish school, and they have the kippah on their head, and it's not a problem for
so
everyone.
As a Jewish person, you feel safer in Morocco, in a Muslim, mostly Arab country, than you did in France, you're saying?
A lot of people say that. But to me, when I was in France, I feel really well. Quoi. It's, mm-hmm. well, it was not a problem, but a lot of Jewish people, when they come here in Morocco, they say, oh, here we can have our kippah on our head. There is no problem, etc. Now we have a big chance to have the Moroccan people really attentive to us. And it's a great chance to live here with our Judaism.
All right, well, that sounds very interesting. So we actually talked to the rabbi today. You were there when we met with Rabbi Chazut here in Casablanca. And he was a little bit less optimistic. He said most children who grow up here leave when they're 18, and that he doesn't recommend wearing a kippah. So can you, I mean, there's obviously some kind of, I guess, tension that some people feel. You know, do you ever see anti-Semitism while you're here?
Yes, for sure. But I think the rabbi is right too. But I think a lot of things are moving now. For me, they are moving in the good way.
Mm-hmm.
You were, I think, in Essaouira this morning or something like that.
Yes.
And then you had certainly seen that some shops write in Hebrew now their menu, etc. After the Accords, Abraham Accords, mm-hmm. A lot of positive things happen here in Morocco. And if you have the good glasses, you can see a lot of positive things here in Morocco.
Right.
And I think it was not perhaps the case 10 years ago. But today, everything is moving in the good way. We have direct flight. We have a lot of Israeli people in the street from Israel,
yeah.
Tourists. And we have, when you speak with some merchants,
mm-hmm.
okay, they, and the people in the hotels, they expect a lot of
yeah.
Israel.
And they recognize Hebrew. And we were in the souk in Marrakesh. Everywhere we went, the people selling things would come to us and go, Rega, Rega.
They are good merchants, you know.
Yes.
So, you know, we don't want to speak about politics.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that the Abraham Accords will be in a long-term perspective, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And we know that during this long story, which is going to happen, we'll know some tensions because everything is not simple in Israel. But we have to think positive, and we have to pass this. All this event here in Morocco with an optimistic way.
All right, let's wrap this up with a fun question. Since so many Israelis are coming to visit Morocco these days, and I ran into a lot of American Jews coming now too, I think they feel safer now that it's safe for Israelis as well. What is the must-see place that someone visiting Morocco should go to?
You know, for me, Essaouira is the place to be visited by Jewish tourists,
mm-hmm.
for sure, because there is so much history in this city. That's great. There are some new museum. They did a lot for the city, and they are renovated some synagogues also. in Jewish tour, you have to be in Essaouira.
Yeah, I really liked Essaouira. I thought it was, Marrakesh is like the tourist city, but I liked Essaouira more. It had a more relaxed sort of atmosphere.
There is a special feeling.
Yeah.
There is a special feeling in Essaouira. Really, the souk is calm, is cool.
It's clean.
It's clean. So they did a great job. And the new mayor is young. And he has a lot of ideas for his city, and I'm sure that today it's wonderful, and in the next days it will be most wonderful.
All right. Well, Jeremy Dahan, working for coexistence between Jews and Muslims, and here in Casablanca. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us this week. You can find us always on all the different podcast platforms, Apple, Google, Spotify. Look for it, share it, and we look forward to seeing you next week.